Chapter 10. The Horse Reanimates.
Gain?
Cern was still elated.
Yes.
How about I just defeat you?
Needles began moving slowly towards Cern, who conjured poison blades for his fight with Alexander, unaware of the presence of Needles. Alexander reached into his messenger bag, crafted as a collaboration between very talented individuals, including himself. He pulled out some thread. Alexander would only have to keep Cern's attention for the fight to be won. In many cases, he thought back, he'd learn of a fight won not by strength, but by focus. The misguided teachers always tell their students to keep a dead-eye focus on their targets, yet recite from the very textbooks summarizing great military struggles decided by a powerful force with too much exertion in one place, too many eggs in one basket. A simple flanking maneuver could topple and cripple forces an order of magnitude greater in size or strength. Perhaps the teachers were only the distraction for a different kind of flanking attack aimed at the students. The fight was clearly in favor of Alexander, as Needles had the element of surprise and Alexander had greater understanding of the situation. Cern, greater strength and all, was a puzzle to be solved in the tailor's eyes. Both fighters understood the valid reading of Cern's superior combat strength, and yet a victory wasn't what Cern vocalized. A game was what he posited. This fact bothered both Needles and his companion. They wondered if he even expected a victory or not. The smile on Cern's face never once faltered. Reading the movements of his opponent, he assumed a ranged fight. Technically, he was right. However, Needles would move in and attempt to trap and even control Cern from close range, while Alexander remained safe at a distance. With Needles being hidden, it would be an act of ease to accomplish, but the intimidation of a second presence being missing could mean that Cern would unknowingly ignore the possibility and change the situation with his focus on Alexander being so great. If he chose to alleviate the advantages Alexander seemed to hold, from his point of view, he would be making an effort to close the gap between the two. This would have the side effect of Needles needing to move on the defensive, despite the tailor's wishes. A brutal finish would be just as easy to pull off for the metallic creature. A victory was not on either fighter's minds, in fact. Alexander was only acting to acquire the object Cern had stolen out from under him. Without knowing the nature of the disappearing object he saw the item placed into, it would be unwise for Cern to be killed, should he desire what he sought. Needles would be willing to give this all up, though, for his Alexander's safety. Verbally silent, the two postured for attack. Needles, meanwhile, steadily glowed towards the knife-wielding man with the smile plastered on. Alexander controlled the threads, a special material, strong and yet flexible, with his Nen to use as weapons.
If I dodge vertically, I won't have the means to dodge a second time. Who knows just what kind of control or damage he can deal with those threads?
Cern casually opined to himself. Needles could tell he was thinking something through and worried he'd already wasted too much time. Cover be damned, he performed the middle ground between the flawless execution of Alexander's strategy and the exact opposite that would be the counter-reaction to a quick attack from Cern. The creature sprung forth towards Cern and gouged his claw-like appendages into his target's person. Cern had been instinctively guarding his body for a sudden lancing attack from Alexander's threads, but even this wasn't enough, as his calculations were made for quick, thin strikes, not clustered piercings. The wounds were very shallow, but the surprise got him to drop his demeanor for a second. He did not notice any significant movement or even a meaningful twitch from his enemy. Skin and flesh would not be read by Alexander as thread, however, and the connection with Cern's clothing would be the only important contact. If the attack had been made through the flesh on a limb, Alexander could identify the tendons as thread, but these strikes occurred center of mass.
What the hell is this? When did you...
Enough!
Alexander shouted as he examined from a distance the drunkard's body, face down in the dirt. No dust kicked up from breath, fading away into the surroundings. Needles thought about two possibilities. One, Cern may think that Alexander is the one that attacked him, and try to counter, potentially causing himself too much harm and providing a much more difficult situation. They easily understood that Cern was not used to not being the one in control in a fight. As such, Needles considered a second potentially detrimental possibility. Without a full reading of the situation, Cern may try and escape out of confusion. The remedy for both seemed easy enough. Though the tailor didn't command it, Needles acted on his own accord. With two hands still connected to Cern's body, Needles let his other arms dangle, slowly revealing himself, beginning with his hands and slowly lifting the veil up his arms. Cern stood agape, smile now dropped into a serious expression, as he was taking in the image beholden to him. Countless needles and needle-like apparatuses forming a conglomerate shape resembling each arm, with protrusions and bone-like extensions, with the purpose of acting as hands all connecting to what was slowly being revealed next. Up he followed with his sight from end to joint to body, shoulders down to what could be described as a chest, then up. The face that appeared before him was a nightmarish terror, a hellish ghoul's expression crafted of indescribably sharp needles of the uncountable variety. To bump into this creature would be to perforate oneself accidentally. Cern was surprised he didn't hear any jingling and clinking metal till now, though upon further inspection it was clear that this creature was tightly gathered and did not flap about with movement. Everything was precise, a needle's point in precision. Each piece was firmly attached, not hanging or swaying about. A self-conscious monstrosity of purely potential pain. All of Alexander's abilities, needles included, were the result of an extremely flexible ability he called pins and needles. The creature named Needles was an unintentional manifestation of his own hidden self. To maintain his life and personality, the tailor developed at a young age the defense mechanism to store and plunge all of his negative feelings deep down. What he didn't expect was for them to crawl back out of the sink of his mind like a swarm of cockroaches somehow, with mutations, sharply grown fangs, and a venomous bite. It isn't rare for these types of reactions to occur. With some, it can subtly redirect your behavior. With others, it can manifest as a mental tic, a disorder. Sometimes a manifestation might just be one of those dark pits finding a way to spit its contents back up into your consciousness. When you add Nen into the equation, the possibilities grow and procreate with each other.
So there were two of you. Now that's a cheap shot.
Cern regained his grin.
Such a hypocrite! The only cheap shot was what you did to that bystander.
Nice of you to refrain from calling him innocent.
Needles chuckled with a chilling reverberation of alloys and jagged surfaces.
Needles. If he tries anything, shred him up into strips that I can use to sew a blanket for that poor man.
He was dead anyways. Let the booze get the best of him. I euthanized the bastard. Should be thanking me.
Needles chirped up.
Give me a reason. Keep clowning around and I'll just have to euthanize you.
Oh, hey, strange guy. Your little pet's clever.
Should be thanking me. I'll give you a quick and painful death.
Cern replied with an appreciative whistle. The tailor walked closer.
That's enough, Needles. We don't want to patronize him. We want answers.
He examined Cern, who was struggling as the clothing he was wearing was tightened around him.
What did you do with that box you took?
That old thing? What's it matter?
It's valuable to me and no one else. It won't even do you any good.
Cern used a fervent slash at his own clothes, leaving himself nude as the tattered remains of his clothes were still being controlled for an attempted grab at him. Needles sprung into the fray to prevent Alexander from endangering himself.
You've just exposed your weak points.
Putting his knives away, Cern commanded attention.
I have no reason to fight you. And if you know what's good for your precious little box, you'd stop fighting me as well.
Stop it, Needles.
Alexander sternly barked.
Now then, what you have witnessed was an ability of mine. It has several conditions that need to be met before you can be allowed back the item you desire. So I'll repeat myself. Shall we play a game?
It's game over, fellas.
Blound leaned over to mention to Tulva, Eata, and Miles Lelex about to be placed into a squad car. Maxwell, following behind Blound, tried not to make eye contact with Tulva or Miles. They didn't make any acknowledgement of him either, for they didn't know what the situation was. Gorik and Kasumi had ridden with the chief in his squad car and were about to bring Miles and Tulva back to the station together. Blound pulled out his phone and dialed, waiting patiently.
Hey, Saf? Yes, are you at the station with Lamino? How's he doing? Okay, I actually have a favor to ask you. Can you go pick up the chief by the docks at the end of Fisher's Paradise? Oh, and can you maybe give me a lift back to the station also? I've got a +1. No, he's a witness. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Do you want to drive, Kasumi? Or should I drive?
Whichever you prefer.
She honestly expected Gorik to drive by default.
Well, I'm not always comfortable driving someone else's car in a city I don't know.
I can drive if you want.
Well, I don't want to put that on you either.
He thought for a second.
Come on, I'll drive if you two can't decide.
Miles was impatient. Gorik decided.
I guess I'll drive, but I'll need you to navigate for me.
Meanwhile, Tolva was so quiet, the other three questioned if he was sleeping or not. He was strangely comfortable with the situation. Miles just wanted to get the ordeal over with. Everyone was now in the car, Kasumi in the front passenger seat. She leaned out the window.
Hey, detective!
What?
How long till your ride gets here?
Shouldn't take too long. You and Gorik go get them processed and ready for questioning.
All right.
She brought her head back in and rolled up the window. Within a minute, the car took off back to the station. Maxwell now found himself alone with Blound, wondering if he could find a way to escape. Back in the hospital, on a different floor from the two officers, one unconscious and one perpetually standing guard, a handful of new admissions were getting settled.
How did she manage to escape him?
Anya whispered to Virgil as they stood near the door to the room Dahlia was in.
Do you know what kind of ability she has?
No, but I thought this Shivra guy was seriously strong. I didn't get any sign from her that she'd be able to handle him.
Well, she didn't really.
Good point. I'd ask her, but she seems so distraught right now.
Virgil ignored her concerns.
Hey, one arm.
Dahlia, tears still glistening on her face, turned to face him.
How'd you stay alive?
I had help.
Anya sprang into energy.
That's right, the guy on the phone. Dahlia, was that a friend of yours?
I don't know who he is.
She tried to prop herself up, but when she motioned to put weight onto her left side and sit up with the help of her arm, she just rolled in that direction. She no longer had the limb necessary to perform that action. Immediately at the failed attempt, tears rolled down her face again. Virgil ignored this sight.
If that really was Shivra, the same guy Law mentioned, then I want to go find him again.
Without Law's help?
I don't know. I just want what he has.
Anya didn't comment. She was left silent in interpretation of his words. Feeling the awkward air, she thought about how to change the topic. She could only come up with one thing.
Let's check around and see if the guy that called me checked in here.
Lahara had just made it back to her room. She was still ecstatic from the results of her talk with Mayor Gray. Now, just as Alexander had found the next step on his journey, so too did she. It wouldn't be long before her goals would take her to the mainland of the UPIO to continue the negotiations. A celebration was in order. Flying into her room, ignoring the foul, sweaty smell of the hallway from the athletic man's constant use, Lahara knew exactly what she'd do. Flinging the door shut behind her in the same swift motion she entered with, she pranced to her bed. On it still lay the dress Alexander made for her. Blistering forces moved the stagnant air in her room as she quickly changed into it. A quick peek in the mirror and glee overtook her. The dress accented her in so many ways, not just physical. She could feel the energy flowing through her.
I actually feel strong, free, less limited in this dress.
She thought to herself as she began moving, watching as the dress moved with her. Out of curiosity, she checked her reflection in the window, as the mirror was now much further away at this point. She had not even noticed her own smile. The whole time, she had been smiling, powerfully, and hadn't even noticed. Through her reflection, she saw the clouds beginning to climb over the island. The temperature was dropping.
Didn't expect it to get so cold,
Candy muttered. Zero didn't quite feel the same.
Feels comfortable to me.
Maybe you're just numb.
Isn't that what happens when you're really cold?
Any number of ways.
Well, regardless, we'll be there soon enough.
A squad car passed them.
It's not a race, Gorik!
He playfully yelled after them. Xaxa was hobbling along almost to the hospital. His broken leg and loss of blood meant the distance seemed far longer than it usually would have. Normally, he'd make the trip in no time. Of course, normally, he wouldn't want to head into the city. Nearing the edge of Cimeterium.
Damn, this was tough. Really working up an appetite with all this struggle.
The hospital was in view. Nearly dragging his leg along, he made it to the building and propped himself up against it. Sliding and scraping his shoulder along the wall, he eventually found the entrance. Battered and covered with dried blood, he caught the attention of many staffers almost instantly. He noticed how much dirtier he was than anyone else in there. With the way he dragged his leg, he accumulated loose dirt and grass, now trailing it inside the building. Some of the people in the lobby looked at him with disgust when noticing the mess he was making. Xaxa thought it silly, given the circumstances. People always find something to be an affront to them, regardless of the reason. It was another reason Xaxa didn't want to be in the city. That, and he didn't want any misunderstandings should he choose to eat.
So I guess the morgue is in the basement,
he quietly said to himself, though a staffer helping him to his room may have overheard him. The room next to his was occupied by a whimpering young girl who had just lost her arm. In her despair, Dahlia didn't even notice Xaxa being taken to the room next to hers. Anya and Virgil were checking rooms, but at this point were on the floor above them, unaware of Chaxa's entry. The next floor up from where Anya and Virgil were contained, the room with the comatose police officer, along with another cop waiting outside the door. After a while of being attended to, he was left alone with his casts and bandages to wallow in pain till he healed properly. He was advised not to leave his bed, except to relieve himself. They told him it was mere luck that he was able to walk, but he knew differently. It was a pure savior known as Whisk that allowed him to walk. That allowed him to breathe. He had to let Candy know, but not over the phone. He arose from his bed. Leaving his room, he took notice of the occupant next door. She was tired enough to be nearing a slumber. Xaxa recognized her.
Hey, glad to see you're okay,
he waltzed in. Dahlia faced him.
You were...
Yeah.
Xaxa, on one crutch, motioned towards some of his injuries.
Was pretty rough.
The other guy?
Whisk.
He saw this as practice for breaking the news to Candy.
He didn't make it.
Dahlia began crying more.
It's because of me.
Oh, no, no. If anything, it's because of Whisk.
He was trying to cheer her up, but knew that comment would never fly with Candy.
Things won't be the same anymore.
Dahlia was referring to the fact that she'd have to unlearn many mannerisms and develop new ones.
That's true.
Xaxa was wondering how Candy might move forward.
Hey, did your friend come and get you here?
Yeah. My friends brought me here after Shivra let me go.
Let you go?
Xaxa was surprised.
Guess we were no help at all.
She continued.
He asked if I still wanted to fight and then left.
Interesting.
Xaxa then thought.
So Whisk might not have been targeted after all. Shivra only attacked me and Shen because we were attacking him. So if Whisk hadn't intercepted, he wouldn't have been targeted.
This caused a long pause for thought as he realized Whisk would still be alive if he were dead in his place.
I wonder if Whisk knew.
The next floor up, Virgil had exited the staircase to see a police officer slouched in a chair in the hallway. Reflexively, he turned around and informed Anya of what he saw. The two began heading back down. Xaxa, however, was making his way much further down, attempting to reach the morgue for a quick snack. On his way, he called Candy.
Hey, Candy.
What is it, Xaxa?
She sounded irritated that he called, not worried.
Where are you right now?
I'm heading to the police station. Why?
I'll be there soon.
Xaxa then hung up on Candy. She put away her phone, grabbing Zero's attention. She wasn't used to being hung up on.
So, who is that?
Zero was just making small talk.
A weird guy. You'll meet him shortly.
Great. Another one.
His sarcasm was thick. Maxwell was sitting in the back of the squad car with Blound, while Officer Saff and Chief Rether occupied the front seats.
Another one of the scammers?
Rether asked Blound.
No, this one's a witness, isn't that right?
Maxwell nervously replied.
Yeah.
Brushing it off, Rether moved to Saff.
How's Lamino doing?
He practically fell asleep when I left him at the station. Seems really worn out.
Saff had a tinge of unease.
It makes sense. Whatever happened to him?
Rether reasoned, though he was as knowledgeable on Nen as Blound or Maxwell. Saff was looking for an answer.
You think these gamblers did this to Lamino?
Maxwell felt himself uncontrollably react. It was a reflex, an impossible-to-hide expression on his face, a short, jagged twitch of a phalanx. a response comparable to the physical cringes Dahlia experiences with her intrusive thoughts. Blound noticed what was stirring with Maxwell, but did not think anything of it.
No, I don't think the two are related. But I don't know why someone did whatever they did to Lamino. It just feels random to me. I can't find a reason.
When it comes to things people do, reason can sometimes seem absent.
Chief Rether spoke normally, but between his spoken words with the others, he held his body with a sort of sadness undetectable to those unlooking. Kasumi and Gorik were leading Miles and Tulver through the station to the now open interrogation rooms. They would question them separately. Every one of them took subtle notice of Lamino asleep on the floor. Baruka was in a holding cell in the back, also asleep at the moment. Rather than question them both simultaneously, they would take turns, Miles first. One would question while the other observed. First up, Gorik wanted a chance to get a chat with them. He knew that Kasumi would be able to get an answer out of them with a form of good cop, better cop using Gaia. Gorik entered the room with Miles. He and Kasumi decided to operate according to a criminal psychology theory of developmental stresses, factoring into adult behavior. To fulfill this approach, Gorik would ask about the subject's childhood and see if any notable keys of their personality would be revealed either by how they talk about their past or by how they react to the questions. Perhaps both, maybe neither. Then they'd be able to reevaluate their recent behaviors with slight knowledge of the foundations for their personalities, without the arduous task of researching their history. The approach was suggested with the interest of time and manpower in mind. From the fight, they suspected anger issues with Miles as he was eager to fight, and then later solidified this assumption with his impatience. Tulver was harder to read, so it made sense to them to interrogate Miles first, and hopefully glean something about Tulver in the process.
Miles, was it?
Yeah, Miles Lelex. I thought you knew that already.
We already know your friend is going to be cooperative. We just wanted to see if you'd comply.
If Tulver's really cooperating, then I will too.
Good.
Gorik sat down. Now he and Miles were on the same level, and it could be seen as an attempt at reducing either party from assuming dominance over the other. However, a myriad of other factors already established Gorik as being more in control and dominant, forcing Miles into discomfort and defensive thought processes. Such was the context of their meeting. Miles was being held, he was unable to leave the room, and he had the looming threat of judicial punishment. Gorik had limited freedom, dominance was unavoidable. It was not lost on the private investigator.
I know you have no choice in the matter, but why don't we both make sure we don't waste each other's time and just get through this as smoothly as possible? Any objection to that idea?
Miles shook his head.
No.
Okay. Now let's get right to it. I want to get to know you outside of the criminal acts we think you did.
This was carefully worded to give Miles hope, a chance to plead his case to them.
Why don't you tell me about yourself? Start when you were young and work your way to this point.
He thought Gorik sounded like a psychiatrist more than a cop.
How far back?
That's up to you.
In fact, the point he chose could very well reveal some minor significance. With this kind of mental maneuvering, the content wasn't the primary objective. It was how the person delivered the content that mattered most.
Well, in school, I'm not ashamed to admit I wasn't good at most classes. Teachers always told us that just because you aren't good at one thing doesn't mean you aren't good at anything. They always said people were just good at different things. But the other kids didn't listen to them. They made fun of me. I couldn't do the things that they could. It was only natural. I understood. It was just because I wasn't smart enough. Being smart seemed really important in school. So, I just resorted to defending myself against them, after I figured out that I could.
Gorik refrained from commenting during his pauses. This is a particular recommendation from people deemed active listeners to elicit elaboration. By holding back a response, it forces the other person to instead continue their thoughts and keep on going. So, after a brief respite, Miles continued none the wiser.
There was this other kid. I knew his name when I was young. For some reason, I just can't. Now, he was so smart that I envied him. I was so damn jealous. He was what I couldn't be. But other people, for some reason, went from bullying me to pushing him around. Names, insults, roughing him up, throwing his stuff around. Like being smart was bad. It was too hard for me to understand. I thought you made fun of someone for their, deficiencies, and he was so much smarter than then. It seemed wrong.
Gorick noticed how he used the word deficiency. It almost seemed to elude him and came out with minor difficulties. Yet he still elected that diction. He wanted to use the word. Miles was revealing himself to be not quite insecure of his own level of intelligence, but self-aware. Hardly considered a numpty, the words flew out of his mind with ease.
The boy couldn't defend himself like I could, so I stepped in. I wish I remembered his name. Every time the bullies found him, I'd try to be there.
Gorick wasn't sure how long he'd be in this time frame.
What about your career?
If I wasn't smart enough to do what others could do in their jobs, I'd just have to work harder. That's what I learned. Other people had it easier than I did in some ways, so I just had to try harder. I worked the shipping yards for years. I did everything I could to make sure I kept my job, but also to make sure they were proud of my work. I wanted the company to be better off for me being a part of it.
Once again, Gorick remained silent. He thought that this would be the most reflective part, the most applicable to his criminal life.
They increased my hours. I thought that it shouldn't change anything. I should keep working hard as always. I always slept best when I had worked hard that day, and I liked a feeling of a full rest. It didn't matter what I was being paid. I would work hard, for me. Even when I hurt, I didn't want to slack. I'd keep going. Then, they lowered my pay, keeping my increased hours. But I didn't want to stop. I needed to earn my good night's rest. And I did, time and time again. I kept on working, as though the pay didn't matter. I thought that might amount to something, if it ever came to it. Well, it came to it, and it turns out it didn't.
Not even Miles was immune to the economic downturn. Kasumi felt guilty watching this. It was like pushing someone to reveal their insides and then standing to the side, judging them, picking them apart. Her conscience was weighing heavy, and she hoped it was for Gorick, too. He felt dirty leading him through this. Necessity bred evil, but they hoped it was at least for a good cause.
Looking back, my happiest moment was when I fought those bullies who were hurting someone else. Before that, it was survival. With the other kid, it was something else. When I was let go, abandoned, that was the worst moment. They didn't give me any of the benefits people usually get from the job. I guess they didn't want to pay me anymore. I guess they didn't see that I was any help for them. I felt like I was a kid being pushed around again, only I couldn't fight back. Turns out a bunch of people had something like that happen to them, and I just wanted some way to fight for them. Maybe then I could be happy. Tolver gave us all an opportunity. I'd only be stupid if I'd said no to him.
Gorick waited for anything else. Miles was done. He said what needed to be said and was ready to listen. The private investigator thought this would work for a place to stop. He wanted to discuss what he heard with Kasumi, but perhaps even more so, he wanted to stop forcing Miles to spill himself out in this small, decrepit room. For now, Miles would await further instruction from the two of them. There was much to be done, as Tolver was quietly waiting a few rooms down, too uncomfortable to sleep, too bored to retain any energy or interest.
What do you think?
Gorick asked Kasumi after exiting the room. She spoke her mind.
This feels wrong, but it seems to be working. Miles knows his limits.
But he's still insecure about them. You think?
That he's doing this as a sort of type of validation?
Something like that.
Gorick ultimately wasn't as interested in Miles as he was of Tulver, who'd been revealed to be a source of admiration for his followers so far. The two were quiet. Each of them was battling with the inevitability of having to repeat this process yet again with someone else. They were giving themselves a break from the prying, but time was of the essence. The longer they take to find out the truth, the more time the potential true culprit has to escape. So far, it didn't seem like Miles was a killer, a fighter, but not one that would take a life. Besides, he seemed to view himself as the hero of the situation, the moral high ground on his side.
I'll do the next one,
Kasumi declared to him, both looking at the floor till that moment. Gorick felt a certain obligation.
You shouldn't do it. I've already got my hands dirty. No need to dirty yours too in this nonsense.
He talked as though murder was being committed.
You think I'm clean?
You think I don't feel like the bad guy just because I stand aside watching? You shouldn't put yourself through this. You're a good guy. This approach isn't meant for us who like to catch crooks in the act. This is for the people who can look at someone's memories and not feel like they're talking to a person. But it works, and we still need to do it, regardless.
You mean regardless of if we feel like we agree with them?
Gorik inched out into the hallway to make his way down to the room Tolva was in.
You feel this way for the same reason I do. These people aren't bad people. They just didn't know how else to fix their situation.
It doesn't seem like they had much of a choice, but still...
Her tone changed to sound as though she would now convince herself of something, which is exactly what Gorik would need to hear as well.
The people they were hurting were more innocent bystanders. They just became part of the problem they lashed out against.
Both of them were experiencing the same sensation of duty tearing them away from their personal ethics. These people did something wrong after being wronged, but they're not bad people. In fact, they are getting a chance to properly know them more intimately, a danger in their position as untrained in this approach as they are, as they could slip out of thinking of them as criminals and instead relating to them as people. The truth of the situation was that Gorik had more experience with this than Kasumi. Desensitization or detachment. Either way, he felt confident that he wouldn't drift too far into empathy for the scammers. He entered the room. Tolva was leaning against one hand, bored, apparently. When another person entered the room, he perked up, straightened his back, and appeared enthusiastic. His plight was ending, his boredom cured. He had a person to converse with.
How's it going?
Gorik hadn't yet sat down.
Good. You?
Not terrible.
Tolva didn't want to appear cocky and give the wrong impression.
Okay.
Gorik made himself comfortable, Kasumi watching Tolva with scrutiny through the one-way glass.
Tolva Iata.
Yep.
We were just talking with Miles, and we were getting to know him a bit. We want to do the same with you. Have you tell us about yourself a little bit?
Did Miles ask for a lawyer?
Gorik froze. Tolva continued.
Is Baruch around here somewhere? Did he ask for a lawyer?
Clearly they did not, but Tolva was smart enough to know it was too late for him anyways.
What you tell us could help you all.
I know. I have no intention of being difficult with you. I also know that if I did request a lawyer, however, that it could take you quite some time. Do you think there are even any lawyers left on the island?
Are you going to cooperate or not?
I am.
Tolva just wanted to send a message. He was much smarter than the others they had questioned.
Well?
Here I go. Here I go,
Tolva assured.
My mom gave me a hard time for my personality. Always said that I was getting myself and her into trouble. I guess my sense of right and wrong was too distinct for many people. When I was young, I thought it was great to point out to people how unethical the laws could be. As I grew, I learned I was better off keeping that fact inside. Many people know that, really. Many people don't. But the ones that do are smart enough to figure out that expressing those thoughts will hurt you in the long run. You've always got to be careful.
Tolva continued as if he knew Gorik would just wait out the silence.
My friends had a different view of me. They thought it was cool how persuasive I was. Always thought I should be a salesman, not an artist or an explorer. A salesman. Hard not to take it as an insult, now that I think of it, but I know they meant well. Just like everyone else, I watched as my friends all moved away. Life became quite stale. So, I had to set out and take a strike in my own life. This was back when Caltech was the place to be for corporate ambition. So, I came here and started climbing the ranks, like I was on stairs, while everyone else was on ladders. I didn't do it for me. I was happy when I moved to Cemeterium. Everything seemed to just click, but I couldn't control everything. My parents were having their own troubles while I was making money. Medical bills, ones that had to be paid, were too much for them to handle. But they managed. It was the rest of their living costs, the cost of living, of being alive, that they fell behind on afterwards. I knew they didn't want to tell me, but they sucked up their pride and asked me for help. I couldn't even imagine how they felt to be forced to do that. That's why I played the corporate game. I got my ranks, did my time, and moved up. When you get this high up, you're set. I was promised that no matter what happened, I'd be compensated for my title. Cue the financial district sliding off the edge of the world, the business world. The top brass got theirs, but there wasn't enough to make sure everyone got theirs. What they did to me, they did to plenty others, just like me. Others not like me, as well. They claimed I was involved with insider trading, sharing secrets with competitors, the general espionage that basically renders you exempt from their promises. The court saw no evidence against these claims, so they sided with the people that made sure the judges' wallets would stay heavy and have enough extra weight to throw around traveling around the world, away from this island. The firm promised me a job if they relocated, but now I was just a trader. Of course it wasn't true. It was the unwritten standard operating procedure. And now, you have a population on this island, in the same sinking boat. The justice system only practices and perpetuates systematic injustice. The name is just a bit of humor for the type of guys like the ones that wrote us all off. Employees and their work were once seen as assets to the company, but numbers are easier to see, so the paychecks just seem too big of liabilities. To them, it didn't balance out on their end of the year statements. People that couldn't see beyond the numbers turning us into statistics in the newspapers. How high do you think the suicide rate shot up after that? Someone had to find a way for all these people in need.
Tulva was done speaking. Gorik understood completely where he was coming from. That didn't make it any easier on him, though. Leaving the room, Gorik said barely another word till he got to Kasumi. Before he said a thing, she started.
I don't think these guys were behind the mess we found.
Gorik thought back on every detail he could muster from when they discovered the massacre of Rafa G's group.
No, I don't believe they had the ability, nor the mentality to do such a thing. But we still have to do something about their scamming.
Yes. The thing is, if they didn't do it, then who did?
Before Gorik could play the guessing game with Kasumi, they both heard someone come in through the door, then another. They stepped out to see who it was. Before they could see who had entered, another person entered, with an extra pair of footsteps. From where they were in the building, they did not hear the squad car pull up. It would take a minute to catch everyone up to speed. Gorik and Kasumi went out to meet with Blound, Saf, and Rether. They were wondering who would take down Maxwell's statement.
I'm sorry, guys. I couldn't help at all,
Chief Rether said amidst the sharing of information.
It's all right, Chief. There's not a whole lot we can really do like this.
Gorik wanted to make him feel as though they didn't just get him out of the way for the fight, which he assumed the Chief might be wondering about.
I know I'm no use in a fight with men. That much is clear to me. I can't do the things that these others can.
Saf was beginning to get Maxwell to give his statement while Blound checked the machines, as was his tradition upon returning to the station. Lamino was still asleep near the front while Tulver was beginning to fall asleep in the back. Baruka was unaware that Miles and Tulver were even in the same building as him.
Hey guys, we got a tip,
Blound shouted.
Someone says there's a body in the field.
The others looked around at each other, wondering what might have happened.
I'll go check it out,
Chief Rether responded.
At least this way I'll be helpful.
Saf and Blound hated seeing the Chief like this. He was their glue, and he was the cause of much of their successes. Saf, also not a Nen user, could empathize with his sentiments, though. Kasumi wanted to help.
All right, we'll keep things steady here till you get back.
Thanks.
He then exited the building. Outside, Candy and Zero were far enough away that the station was a minute or so's run away, but could still see the Chief exit with detail. Candy, not remembering what Gorik looked like.
That's not him, right?
Zero squinted to make sure.
Right, that's someone else.
Rether got in a squad car and began driving his way to the edge of the city. Candy and Zero made progress towards closing the distance between themselves and the station. Xaxa was a ways away, slowly crossing through the city. It was his first time in the city, and he was taking it all in while walking a pace slower than the average person. He thought about how Whisk avoided large groups of people and compared that to the strange stares he, a bandaged man, was getting from the passers-by. He came to the conclusion that Whisk was onto something. Lahara was sitting on her bed, thinking about how lucky she was with her dress. All the people down on the ground, walking by the building, wouldn't even know. How could they? She had the idea to celebrate. She wanted to get Dahlia in her dress and go find some fun in the city, maybe find a way to thank Alexander. Before she could even get up to make her way to where she left her phone, it rang. A new game entered her mind. Who could it be? Who had my number, she wondered. The largest possibilities were those that she would have been calling anyways.
Hello?
Lahara answered, trying to keep in her light and fluffy feeling.
Hi, is this Lahara?
Yes.
She didn't recognize the voice.
I'm calling from the West Cemeterium Hospital, and your friend Dahlia is here. When I asked her if there was anyone who could maybe look after her, she mentioned something about some friends. I think you should come down here and pay her a visit. I'm sorry to tell you, but she's in rough shape.
Lahara was now keeping her voice from shaking.
Oh.
I'm sorry to be so blunt, but I don't want to waste her time.
What happened?
We're not sure. We'll have the police take a statement from her, but it seems, for the moment, that she's had some kind of an accident.
I understand.
I'm so sorry to be calling you like this. With the storm, though, we're just worried you won't be able to come see her once it's begun to hit.
I'll be there soon.
It felt hard to say.
Thank you.
Once again, I'm sorry. Bye.
Bye.
Lahara put her phone down. Without thinking, she got her shoes on and hurried back into the hallway, permeated by body odor from the mysterious man's passing by, and strutted out of the lobby onto the street. As she hurried, people she passed took an appreciative glance at her beautiful dress, like something out of a movie they saw as kids. Back when children only had to worry about when they could watch the next magical movie of romance and infinite potential. Realizing how long a walk would take, she lamented the lack of taxis on the island. Unease consumed her as she wondered what Dahlia's condition might be. However long it would take to reach the hospital would be too long for her. Dahlia, lying in bed, was close to falling asleep when Anya and Virgil re-entered her room.
How are you doing?
Anya was genuinely concerned.
She's probably doing shitty. Her arm just got cut off.
Anya shot a devilish glare at him, while Dahlia showed a concerned look that seemed to corroborate Virgil's statement.
It's good that you were able to do what you did with the wound on the spot, Dahlia.
Anya was trying to make her feel better.
Oh, otherwise, ha! They might have had to cut off more. The damage might have been so that the Haid need to pull out that saw and knock you out.
She was giggling through her words. Even Virgil was surprised at Anya's odd sense of humor. An interesting quirk she picked up through her years accumulating medical experience. Experience was still the number one thing she was searching for. Particular experiences, ones of fear. She had missed her opportunity with Dahlia. Loss of limbs triggers several fears, some deep, core ones as well. Self-harm is an innate evolutionary fear. Overcoming this fear is often seen as a disorder. Just being around Dahlia, Anya was storing some of the residual fears she was experiencing in bed, reliving the experience and thinking on her future. Shivra was bearing her many gifts. But Lore may bear the best gift of all, Shivra's fear, if they could pull it off. She'd still yet to harvest from Virgil, and his own motives could prove incongruous with Lore's. In the back of the police station, Baruka was waking up from hunger. With the police so busy chasing the scammers and searching out Lamino, no one had provided their prisoner with sustenance. He waited for a period of time. Then, out of discomfort, he yelled,
"Can I get some food back here?"
Indeed, it was a hearty yell as his voice reached those in the front of the police station, even causing Lamino's tired eyes to flutter open. Maxwell was startled to hear it, as it was someone he didn't know. Unaware of anyone else in the building besides those in his immediate knowledge, he wondered who it could be. Gorik, Kasumi, and Blound knew from the moment the voice reached their ears who it was and just what mistake they had made. An easy remedy, but the damage was done. Only slightly muffled, the sound of Baruka's yell entered the interrogation rooms. Tulver and Miles both separately heard the voice simultaneously. Knowing that Baruka was in the same building as them, certain possibilities could open up. Tulver assured them that this wasn't a part of their motives. But Gorik and Kasumi both wondered why they let themselves go so easily. To be a distraction, yes. But what if it was only because they knew they had an easy escape available to them?
I'll bring him the food,
Gorik volunteered. Blound was still questioning and writing down Maxwell's account, ironing out the fuzzy details from his vantage point and his absence of certain incriminating details. Kasumi walked over to take a look at Lamino, who slowly propped himself upright. His head seemed to hurt. Kasumi theorized that it might have just been from a poor night's rest and too much activity while depriving himself of sleep. This didn't contradict the leading Nen-based theory, it should be noted.
How are you doing?
Her voice was calm, soothing, almost as Gaia's.
Ugh.
He looked around.
When did I get back here?
Saf brought you.
Blound shouted over, ignoring his duty concerning Maxwell briefly.
Ugh, I feel awful.
Before they could talk any more with Lamino, someone walked in the front door. As Blound looked across the room, another walked in. Kasumi got up to greet them. Candy and Zero had finally arrived at the station. Wasting no time, Candy directed her question to Kasumi.
Where's Gorik?
Kasumi looked at her, then to Zero.
He's in the back. He'll be here shortly.
Good.
Candy was glad to no longer have to walk alongside Zero for too long.
I'd like to talk to him as well. He'll probably recognize me.
Zero wanted to clarify that he and Candy were on separate business.
Like I said, he'll be here soon. So what do you want to talk to him about?
Candy thought about it.
That's right. I don't need to talk to Gorik specifically. Who do I talk to about information I have about certain things going on around the island?
Well, Detective Blound is busy, so I can take your information down while your friend here waits for Gorik.
He's not a friend.
Candy seemed adamant about that.
I thought we were bonding.
Zero joked to her. Without reply, Candy began walking toward Kasumi, who just shrugged a sympathy gesture at Zero. He didn't actually care. In fact, he was quite glad. He was ready to ask Gorik questions, after having seemingly exhausted other options for individuals who might know something about his past.
So, miss, may I ask your name before we begin? I'm Kasumi, by the way.
Kasumi shook Candy's hand.
I'm Candy Rye. Nice to meet someone else who seems a little bit normal on this island.
I take it you've gotten to know some of the other guests?
Kasumi was thinking of a way to refer to them all without potentially triggering ire.
Are you from here?
Oh, no, I just came to help.
That's what I thought I was doing as well.
Their conversation was interrupted when Gorik came into the fray, noticing Zero.
Well, if it isn't Mr. Single Digit.
Gorik sounded pleased.
What was it? 3? No, 2. Wait, 1.
Are you about to explode, Mr. Time Bomb?
Gorik walked up and shook Zero's hand.
Wait, now I've got it. Integer?
Zero continued playing along.
I'm just glad you can count. After all this time, I still wasn't sure.
At least I'm not nothing.
Close enough. Let's give a round of applause to Gorik, everyone. He can almost remember someone's name.
Gorik got a little more serious.
What do you want, Zero?
I just want to talk your ear off about something. An inquiry.
Well, I'll do my best, but we are kind of busy here.
Won't take more than a second.
While their course introductions were taking place, Kasumi and Candy gradually shifted attention back to each other.
That's when we found it. The garage.
Kasumi was shocked.
You found it?
Yes, after you guys. We saw the police tape.
So then, you can identify the bodies?
Yes, we already did. What we could, anyways. All we knew was that they were staying there, and that they were hunting Shivra Nyarl.
We?
Kasumi reluctantly considered Zero as the other.
My friend Whisk.
Candy briefly wondered how things were going with him and Hon.
Do you think Shivra did all that by himself?
From what I understand of him, yes.
Candy was uneasy.
That answers a few of our questions. Wow, thank you.
Kasumi had no idea that they'd be getting this much information out of a stranger. Just as Zero was beginning to ask Gorik some questions, a person walked through the door. Not so much walked as hobbled. Xaxa had finally managed to make it to the station. Lahara stormed through the hospital, blistering about the hallways, chirping out questions for instruction, peeling around corners and sliding to a halt. Anya and Virgil were standing outside Dahlia's door, but made way for Lahara to enter, whose eyes were strained from her exertion.
Must be a friend,
Virgil assumed aloud. Anya agreed.
Let's let them be for a moment.
The two of them walked a bit down the hall. Lahara made her way to the bed, slowly taking in the vacuum that now occupied her left arm's place. She knelt so as to be closer to Dahlia's level. Dahlia, tears blurring her vision, almost attempted to reach out with her left arm, but the stitched-up stump only twitched as she remembered her fate.
Dahlia!
Lahara was having trouble keeping in her tears.
I'm sorry.
You look beautiful.
I should have been there.
No.
Dahlia rubbed her eyes with her right hand, making sure to rub both, somewhat awkwardly as she began to relearn the necessary movements.
I needed to go alone.
Lahara, swelling with a sense of guilt.
What happened?
This man, I don't know. But these others, they came and helped.
Who?
Lahara made sure to find and thank whomever helped her friend survive.
I can't really remember. I was in pain.
I'm so sorry, Dahlia.
Moisture began overflowing her eyelids, blinking in futile attempts to gloss it over her eyes and prevent tears from rolling down her face. Dahlia went back to looking at her.
Your dress looks wonderful.
Lahara, realizing the gloating image wearing the dress here might seem from the outside perspective.
I didn't mean to.
It's okay. I didn't want to make you feel bad for wearing it. It looks great on you.
Trying to make her feel better.
I can bring your dress here, if you'd like.
Dahlia, gleefully free of intrusive thoughts in this moment.
Alexander did say that the sleeve would need to be readjusted.
The two paused, then giggled through their tears before returning to a solemn pitch. In this quiet result, they both found a momentary feeling of rest and peace. Amidst the tumultuous context, Cern and Alexander were standing in a peaceful air.
I don't think I have a choice. I'll play your game.
Needles displayed his own intentions.
If it doesn't satisfy us, I'll kill you.
He knew Cern could be a threat if the circumstances were right, which could be Cern's goal, setting up the right situation.
You seem like a pious fellow. This game will require a little something more.
Don't assume. You don't know the horrors I've seen.
Alexander was insulted.
What you've seen and who you are two different things, though. I can tell you hate death, for good reason. I think this opens up some fun.
Cern was reveling in the fact that he now had these two hanging on his every word.
Death's briefcase can only appear when I kill someone, and I can only remove or place in it one item per appearance. If I die, the contents will disappear, forever. You want whatever this is so bad, bad enough to kill for it?
Alexander grew full of worry. Needles cared not for the notion of killing. He was just worried what Cern might try against them as part of this game, or for what purpose he was playing it. Cern cheerfully continued.
So, I want you to choose who dies next, so you can get your precious little box back.